Blog Talk Radio.
Would be the normal place where we would run all of the high-priced ads, but since this is what we would call an indie operation, I think Freemasonry is probably the most indie of them all. Hello out there. It is December 22nd, 2013. This is the 356th day of the year. It's wonderful because this is, if you're inclined, this is the start of the period of Capricorn. So if you're born on December 22nd, you're probably best known for your patience. You know, the qualities that that I don't have, your patience, your determination, your hardworking nature. But you like to stay focused. You know, explain why you much rather be actively working toward a goal than thinking about it. I like this kind of person. You do well with them. Back not so long ago, this was quite a determinant of character and personality. And some people, we still fancy some of this today. Earth is the Capricorn's paired element, and it is a sun sign, of course. And it's you're the only one to have a cardinal relationship with this element. So if you're born today, I guess that makes makes Jesus a Capricorn, doesn't it? Yeah, I don't know. I wonder when they say Allah, peace be with him, is born. I'm not really sure. Anyway, you are realistic and practical in your goals and expectations. Man, does that sound like you? There's a few celebrities here. Vanessa Paradis, Johnny Depp. Yeah, Mary. You share a birthday with Johnny Depp. So there you go. That's didn't Johnny Depp just turn 50? And I'm glad this week that finally Brad Pitt turned 50. That makes the rest of us look brilliant, doesn't it? It's interesting that you should bring that up. This is coming into the solstice, isn't it? Winter solstice, and what do we have? That's not that long away. As a matter of fact, you may think that this is the winter solstice began yesterday at 11 p.m. So, you know, not so long ago, December 21st. It's the shortest day of the year. You noticed that, didn't you? And I noticed you out there with your robes and holly and looking at searching the skies. Here we're under this beautiful bank of snow. So you know, save yourself. don't waste a lot of time looking for the sun on the. Brethren, Merry Christmas. Don't let me go on any more than that. Merry, Merry Christmas, and welcome. I'm your host for the show today, Dale Graham, and thanks very much for joining me. For the usual things Masonic, you know that you're a small but dedicated group of people, I would say, compared to the entire Masonic adventure out there. I'd like to think that that says something about the quality of the conversation that we have. I'd like to, this year I'm going to dedicate myself, the program, to greater consistency and trying to continue to meet, to address the question that you have. The question that bring you to the questions that bring you to the program. It's just an amazing world that we live in, and so much of the time I feel like I suppose a lot of us do, that these studied, brilliant deliveries and very eloquent speakers are so much superior, that how could somebody that stumbles over a phrase here and there have anything to possibly attract, have anything to say to an audience? And yet there you have it. We all have a point to make, and the Masonic Companion is to bring that discussion that you don't have, that you may have, and that you may want to have, but about things Masonic, but at a time that suits you. I hope that this is a more, perhaps the contemplative discussion that may not fit into the hurly-burly of lodge function. And that's quite all right. You know, there's lots of things that lodges have to do. In an ideal world, we wouldn't have questions. We'd only have answers. And but then we'd have to sort out our priorities nevertheless. Yeah. It's Christmas time. It is right now 2 days, 15 hours, and 52 minutes, and 57 seconds until Christmas. So there you go. There you have it. You can get a counter for your I remember when our daughter was little, this would be an enormously, this would be the most important thing to mark off Santa Claus' arrival. So to all of you who are waiting for Santa Claus, he's coming, and he knows whether you've been, he knows what you've been up to for the past year. Oh dear, wouldn't you like to have a sit down with that fella? Anyway, this is an opportunity for us to sit back and stretch and relax and talk about things. I wanted to as usual, I puzzle over things. But I need to set a little bit of a mood before I get into this, a little bit of an atmosphere. So today, I find this period of life and this time of year a most wonderful experience. It is an amazing experience. And this is where we draw, I think, more firmly on our beliefs as Freemasons than other times of the year. Not that it's unimportant other times, but this is a really does showcase what we are able to accomplish. We bring, and I hope you do, happiness and contentment to when you walk into the room. If, as the Dalai Lama said, he didn't send me a card this year, but I think I follow him on Twitter. If you want others to be happy, practice compassion. If you want to be happy, practice compassion. That's caring for your fellow man or woman. Happiness often sneaks in through a door you didn't know you left open, according to John Barrymore. But I like this from William E. Gladstone. He said, be happy with what you have and are. Be generous with both, and you won't have to hunt for happiness. Accept yourself. Maybe a little bit. I'm studying some material about the nature of temperament and personality. So maybe I'll get into a bit of that. It addresses what Gladstone is saying about that. Talking about the introvert and the extrovert and the high rate reactive traits that are evident from the time evident in babies. Oscar Wilde said, some cause happiness wherever they go. Others whenever they go. Amen to that, brother. The Constitution only gives people the right to pursue happiness. You have to catch it for yourself. And that's Benjamin Franklin, the brother Franklin, of course. And another one from Mason, George Bernard Shaw. Just do what must be done. This may not be happiness, but it is greatness. You know? Happiness, says Dale Carnegie, doesn't depend on any external conditions. It is governed by our mental attitude. That's what I'm talking about. Your mental attitude, your focus. When you walk into the room, you bring that with you. And don't let it go just because you have an unwelcome, a tense situation that you're walking in. That's fine. Those are the people and the situations that need us most. There's only one way to happiness, and that is to cease worrying about things which are beyond the power of our will. Now, this came from Epictetus, the Greek philosopher. Don't be thinking that this is an individual, this is a daunting task for the individual, for me or you. This is something that's part of our nature as human beings. And that's what we're talking about here. Ah, oh, man, what do you really need to be happy? Think about it while we're going on here. So I hope that sets a little bit of the mood here. Amazing world. You know what they've discovered? This is like, you know, anybody that says that modern times are a corruption of what's gone on in the past, give your head a shake. If you and I were sitting with tools, the 14th century tools, and somebody came along with better tools to allow us to do our job, you and I both know that we would not be the last in that lodge to grab those tools and make our job better. We would always look. We always did, and we always will. We may not have the comfort and the education and the familiarity of working in a guild to be able to have a mentor looking over our shoulder teaching us. But we can darn well learn from them and remember our history. We can remember that if there was a better way of sharpening our tool, we would be taught that. Not, oh, gee, we've always done it this way. But remember, as soon as you're doing that, these guilds became progressive because they earned the reputation for high quality. That's how they did it. Do what's necessary. Remember. So I want to remind you, it's fascinating. We're producing some fascinating minds here. Who developed this? One of you did this. Graphene. Now, one of you developed this, I know. So step forward. Give me a call and let me know. Dale, I developed it and it came to me in a night. This is a sheet of carbon that's one atom thick. One atom thick. It's extremely strong and conducts electricity, and it's the thinnest material ever made. And the scientists believe that it could be used as a transparent electrode in, what do they call it, photovoltaic cells, replacing layer of iridium tin oxide that is brittle and becoming increasingly expensive. This is just the most amazing. They found that graphene, one molecule thick, outperforms the iridium when used. We were thinking, solar cells that absorb broad spectrum light, it allows more than 97% of light to pass through to the cell beneath, regardless of its wavelength. Think about it. So, I know. This is just, does it matter? Of course it matters. It's an amazing time. But we have, I think, an interesting program on the go today. I'll just tuck into that for a second. I talked about a step back in time, and I became, enormously happy and enthusiastic about another one of life's discoveries, one of those aha moments. I seem, as I get older, to be having those a lot, like, aha, there's my socks. There. Aha, that's how to avoid another argument. Therapy. I have, you know, I know that aha is supposed to be those moments of inspiration, but I seem to be inspired, you know. I have to bend down and look under the bed and think, oh, there's that belt I haven't found since the summertime. Oh, there you go. That's an aha moment for me. I'm aiming low. I don't want to be disappointed. I know I'm the only past, present, and future are one. You can tell I've been listening to physicists, eh? Yeah, there you go. If anyone reading this is like me, you wear a watch and you put clocks around your house, or today you carry a cell phone that displays digital time. Our lives are coordinated with the belief better to coordinate than live in timeless chaos. Funny that. Earth was the original clock, replete with stars and moon. Daniel Boorstein explained minutes and hours in a way that even I could follow. Like, how did you ever calculate that? What it is? I can tell you what a minute is, and I tell you what an hour is, but but lately I've been realizing that while I can understand how it's measured, I have no idea what it is we're measuring. Now, this is where the all of you that are the sons of Stephen Hawking will stand up and say, oh, I know, of course, you know, all of you relatives from that gene pool. You know, he's 71 years old. It was just, you know, frank, amazing mind. Man, we're fortunate to be living in these days. But I've been realizing, I just have no idea what it is. Time and space has become, you know, that's changed. Like, I was just trying to get my head around that. Like, you know, we saw the films of Albert Einstein, and we see these horrific pictures of the effects of atomic warfare. When hell comes to is unleashed on Earth, no man has the right to do that. I'm sorry, no man, nobody, for any reason can ever justify that kind of hell on Earth. Anyway, so we can create things that create hell on Earth there. But those are grim and historic indicators of things going on about physics, power. And it always seems to get into time and space. And we learned that, you know, the condition and properties of light, it can be a particle and it can be a wave. We learned that gravity can bend. We learn all of these things. And then just as you're sort of saying, well, you know, that's not going to help me change the tire, is it? Well, it's a question that does beg our understanding. Like, why are things like this? And so we now are in a time of time-space where there isn't a separation anymore. So they took out the hyphen. So I'm again, what in the hell? But we know that time bends. If it matters at all, time is not the same for everybody. Whether we are moving or stopped affects time. When we are in motion, time goes faster. In my corner of the universe, I realize there are people much smarter than me, like all of you out there. As I get older, I understand more about knowledge and understanding than I did when I was younger. And in my profession, I study the activity of the brain that fills in information for us. It does. It fills in information to ensure we have a sense above all else that we understand what our senses tell us. You ever talk to somebody and say, oh, do you know what I mean? And the person, it's our tendency. It's not the person giving us trying to snow us. Our tendency is to say, yeah, I follow that. Dale, you understand the dynamics of particle physics? Oh, yeah, sure, I got that covered. That's, you wonder where that comes from? No, it's not missing Sunday school. I didn't miss many of those. It has to do with brain function. Who knew? All right, so give us all the benefit of the doubt. Now we're able to measure things. We have better tools today than we had 1,000 years ago. Yeah? Okay. That makes sense. So now we're able to measure things that we didn't understand prior. What is the measurement of the things that we're trying to measure? I don't know. But I studied the activity that fills in answers. Perception, you know, these eyewitnesses, everybody, five people witness something going on, you get five different versions. Everybody is saying, I'm telling the truth. Don't you ever challenge me. This is what eyewitness testimony convicted many a person. And now we find, be careful. What people say is not necessarily what happened. And that's the truth. It's perception. Are physics working metaphorically? You know, are these physicists? Are they working? Are they talking to us as a metaphor? Are they the alchemists? Is this the dark magic of wizards? You know, what are they up to? Probably neither. Probably more likely to understand this idea, we need to stretch thinking. To hell with positivism? Yeah, I guess. Positivism, you know, it's, you know, I've been talking here on Masonic Companion about the Hellenistic philosophies, Stoicism, Epicureanism, and, you know, we, and that being replaced by positive, our philosophy is based on an assertion that it's fact that we can depend on. We have to be able to prove our statements. We can't just say it. We can't just think it. We can't just believe it. We need a proof. So the Stoic, the Epicurean, what do they tell us? If this assertion is fact, if we Freemasons are connected to an intense temporal fusion with past and future, temporal fusion, time, you and I, the order, the craft, we draw on a keen awareness of, you know, we have to work to keep everything up because time is a very harsh judge. History is an enormously harsh judge, no appeal process. If we screw up, history will tell us, not you and I, patting each other on the back, saying, oh, we're doing a fine job. History judges us. Well, we look at the history, 300 years of Freemasonry, and probably a little more than that, but 300 years that we can, you know, nice and organized and bureaucratically focused, we can say, you know, the history is telling us that something is going along, and you and I can put our thumbprint on it, saying, and that's it, it's moving along well. It really is. It's moving along exceptionally well. And so where do we go from there? What's that value judgment based on? Well, I think it's based on the fact that we have a sense of goal and purpose, and we have a sense that throughout our history, we've been able to achieve it because it continues to attract thoughtful, reasonable men. And we would say that if we were not, if the craft was not doing as accomplishing, delivering the goods over the centuries, it would fail. No matter if we started something, you know, something really out there, just bizarre. That's, you know, those types of organizations have gone on in the past, and they dissolve. They always dissolve. But this is endured. So there's something there. And that something, I think, is like particle physics. It's like we have this sense, perhaps it's a belief that it's something there, and we have a proof. Time has proved that there's something valuable in our order. And there's a gravity that drew you to this. However you got there, whether it's sentimental or not, isn't really as important as the fact that there was an orbit and there was a gravity that exists today. Now, what is it? Can you measure that gravity? Man, I wish we could, eh? I'm not really sure. Is this, you know, that being the case, I look at us, you, me, 3.5-4 million Masons around the world, it's this link, this not glue, but these atoms that connect the past and the future. It's like a flow through, isn't it? We might, that being the case, we might, if we sit back and put our hands behind our head, we might just then understand more about the craft than we care to acknowledge. You know, we may have an understanding inside of our minds that we haven't defined in words. Is this the metaphysical aspect of the craft? I think, yeah. Best to keep this behind a closed door. Not so radical to our ancient brethren, but today. not so radical. This wasn't radical to our ancient brethren. But today, you're going to walk around talking about beliefs not without being able to prove it. We can prove order. We can prove uniformity. We can prove compliance. But this, this is subversive. This is dangerous. This is thought. Man. Anyway, are we on the same page? I think. Turn with me to Masonic history and development in Canada, you know. I always want to bring it back home. It's really important to bring it back home. I know that there's been, you know, if you and I challenge each other and we say, no, tell me, I want you to think out there, what are the three most significant events in the course of Masonic history? What are the three? Now you might say, all right, Dale, it's the Hiramic legend. Be okay. There was a time pre and a time post. You might say it is the Constitution, develop up a Constitution, being able to put a codex together. You know, this is how we're going to do this. You can do something else. You can call it this. You can call it the craft. Call it whatever you want. It's a free world. But within our order, we're going to do things that we think that there's some things that we need to hold in common, ideas and beliefs and principles. So if you believe those, if you went into this way of thinking, if you subscribe to this kind of thinking, then we can cohabit, we can mingle, we can exist in the same, you know, we can join together and see what comes of that. And meet the current challenges. We're not going to meet the challenges of 17th century or 18th century. You know, it's like 16th, 17th century, you were still locking up your shutters and because of the darkness, there was dangers. People still believed that the fairies would come out and there were creatures and spirits that could do unpleasant things. There was danger in the night. So, you know, now we prove it, don't we? We can prove it with some understanding. Just because there's darkness doesn't mean a room is any more dangerous than whether it's lit like a Walmart store. And by the way, if you're planning to build a Masonic lodge, lighting it like a Walmart store is, maybe better to light it as a lodge rather than as a, you know, a waiting room or something like that. What are we waiting for? Bright lights to melt the plastic on my wristband. Anyway, of all points, there were and still are many workings of rites put into use across our land. Mm-hmm. To further complicate that complexity, the Grand Lodge of Scotland at that time, you know, in the early days, had not adopted a standard ritual. A lodge under its jurisdiction could practice any recognized work it wished, providing it was not inconsistent with Freemasonry. We find reports of the application of this flexibility put to good use later in this history. With the loose alliances and poor communications of the day, the visitations of masters and past masters of various rites and workings to some degree further adulterated those endeavoring to maintain some degree of consistency. Remember, you know, therein is the strength of a constitution. There's in strength of agreeing this is the ritual that we're going to perform. Now, you may say, we can all rewrite it. We can, you know, there's nothing wrong with any ritual that's modified. And then others, like me, would say, well, what if there? How do we have an understanding that the essentials are going to be maintained? Wouldn't that cause us to drift into some perhaps the modifications of some of the essentials and the removal of those essential elements? I can't answer that question. So rather, until I can, I want to preserve and protect the obligations. So I want Yeah, I think that there's some need for, key need for uniformity, so that the obligation a fellow is taking today and the obligation the fellow is taking 100 years from now, with the except for some minor, you know, grammatical changes, the content has remained the same. You ask, or you bring a suggestion, and Grand Lodge is very, very receptive to questions and suggestions about the ritual. But there's always a very careful and deliberate, sober-minded review, because you want to be consistent with the context of the section that we're talking about. And we want to make sure that there's continuity that's protected. Brilliant. So, in June 1849, it was resolved that the Right Worshipful Provincial Grand Master do elect some well-skilled master or past master of a lodge from time to time, who shall have power and authority as a district lecturer, with power to summon masters and wardens of lodges in his district, to proceed to and visit lodges in his district in which he may reside and instruct them accordingly. And such appointment is to remain valid until a grand lecturer be appointed. The said district lecturer to receive no salary, there you go, from the funds, of course not, from the funds of the Provincial Grand Lodge. Coburg, June, that was written in Hamilton, June 1840. The following year, in June 1849, resolved that a committee of five be appointed for the purpose of establishing a uniform mode of working. This committee was to report in the half-yearly communication in November. In Toronto, in November of that same year, 1849, direction was made to the Board of General Purpose to inquire why the committee on a uniform mode of working had not reported. Well, you had 6 months. I laugh because I would think that would be a very daunting task. This problem was not peculiar to Canada. One has only to study the history and formation of the United Grand Lodge of England to verify that. The creation and story of the Emulation Lodge of Improvement, or the Lodge of Reconciliation, could be more than enough material for any lecture. I'm hard-pressed to cover this subject without getting more into English history. Not a problem, but maybe not for today. Examination, June 1850. You look at the communication. It indicates that the climate and attitude at the time was that attention were probably fixed on the matter of an autonomous Grand Lodge in Upper Canada, of course. Not that ritual isn't important, but man, gentlemen that were trying to bring about an authority here in Upper Canada to allow us to conduct the work of Freemasonry were remarkable. I am so proud to be part of an organization that can say, that can cite the history of what those men were able to do. Truly. For all that we can say, it must have been daft. Why not the revolutionary spirit that was going on south of the border? Do it yourself. Hell with them. Well, I say this is a connection, a historical connection. And for Masons like me, it is important. Maybe that's the Canadian in me speaking. I don't know. Yeah, I do know. I think it is. I'm very proud to be part of this organization, as I'm sure you are. Interesting subject of the many workings of rituals practiced in various Canadian jurisdictions. We'll get into them. Ancient Freemasonry has its Regis manuscript. Canada has its own link with antiquity. And I referred, think about the Masonic Stone down on, or Nova Scotia stone. It's a piece of a rock about 2.5 feet long and 2 feet wide. It has an inscription. It has the inscription as a square compass and the date 1606. Yeah. And for the geologists, like my friend Cal out there, indigenous rock of the kind formed the substratum of Granville Mountain. There you go. This slab was found on the shore of Goat Island in an Annapolis Basin in Nova Scotia. Well, there's a pilgrimage. I'll see you all on the road next summer, and we all have to head to go down there, boys. And while you're down there, get yourself a bit of lobster and a few beer on the way. We'll sit down, we'll have a talk, and we'll have a look at this stone. I hope that, you know, they've got it a little bit protected so people aren't tramping all over it. Anyway, conjecture is that, you know, like, where did that come from? It may have been the gravestone of an early settler, you know. People were, there's burial ground not too far away. And it's known, at least to the colonists, well, at least we hit the records show that at least one guy died in 1606. But Champlain, because Champlain made a record of it, and the guy died on the 14th of November, 1606. This historical is a cross-reference. It was, you know, donated to the Canadian Institute of Toronto to be set in the wall of their new building, which is under construction. This valuable historic artifact. Pictures of the stone were taken, and an entry record of his receipt made in the minutes of the Institute. It is fortunate that that was done, for the plasterer stupidly covered the entire wall with plaster, and even the spot cannot be traced. If the entire building should ever be torn down, it is hoped that a diligent and careful search be made for this Masonic treasure. Man, I have found that the saying, no one has done more to change the course of history than the historians, holds true for Masonic history as well. Much speculation regarding when and where the first lodges met can be found, but no evidence is available to support it. Even the most reliable sources vary in the dates they proffer in the same subject. So here's a bit of a stab. The first Masonic lodge of record appears in the locality of Nova Scotia, where the stone was discovered, and there are claims that as early as 1721, there was a Masonic lodge in Annapolis Royal. Erasmus James Phillips. Now, there is a, you know, wonderful name. A good friend over in Collingwood, Peter. I think he spells it the same name. He was born in Boston. He was a Mason in 1737. He returned back to Annapolis Royal. Now, this wasn't too unusual. I'm a Graham from Prince Edward Island, and we had relatives in Boston. So, you know, United Empire loyalists, I don't know, we can, you know, how they got there, you know. The older members of the family probably remember because they were there. But this isn't unusual if you're from the East Coast, and you, not at all. It established what is considered the first lodge in Canada, and it was under the charter from Massachusetts. It is certainly conceivable that there were military lodges in existence before 1738. But, you know, the approvable bit of history, that's the 1738 Boston, you know, Annapolis Royal. Moving east to west, oh, there's a metaphor that's just too juicy for us to ignore. Don't talk to the Maritimers about that one, huh? We see a pattern of dates from the earliest authenticated charters. Newfoundland received her charter from Massachusetts in 1746. PEI from the Provincial Grand Lodge in Halifax in 1797, and Nova Scotia. The Blue Noses in Nova Scotia from Massachusetts in 1738. New Brunswick from Halifax in 1789. And Quebec and military lodges meeting there after the siege and capture of the Citadel in 1759. Did you know Wolfe was at Culloden? Yeah, did you know that? Yeah. Anyway, but there's no record of the Grand Lodge of England issuing warrants to Quebec before 1762. Worthy of mention, no kidding, were that there were six lodges warranted by the Grand Lodge of Boston during the American expedition against Canada. I think we put those fellows out, didn't we? Yeah, we sent them back and go home, you know. Learn how to, here's a hockey stick, learn how to play it and come on back. And don't be messing, and we'll give you a plate of poutine when you're on your way. 1756, which occurred in, you know, this is in Ontario, traces her Masonic birthplace to the Niagara area, which is now Fort Niagara in the United States. That's where the Niagara event occurred. Back when the, you know, that border was a little, things were a little bit dodgy. Battles went on for a while for a reason. Military Lodge of the 8th King's Regiment of Foot, met and worked there regularly from 1773 to 1785. And it drew members from both sides of the river. Niagara River, south of that is, of course, upstate New York. And the other part is what we know as Upper Canada, Ontario. Manitoba had its first charter from Minnesota in 1863. And Saskatchewan, I love the people. Don't you love the people? Go riders from Grand Lodge of Canada in Ontario in 1879. There you go. Saskatchewan from the Grand Lodge of Canada in Ontario. 1718. Why am I? It's like my part of my tongue. My mouth is dyslexic. My brain knows. Alberta from Manitoba in 1882 and British Columbia from the Grand Lodge of England in 1859. Well, there's all things. Don't they still have high tea out in Vancouver? Don't they? Oh, God bless them over there. Never know what they do on the other side of the. We should send a Masonic delegation to go and, you know, climb over the mountains and see what they're doing over there in the Pacific Rim. What kind of mischief those folks are up to. These original dispensations were cited for historical precedent. Remember, let me just go back instead of screwing around here. Saskatchewan was given a charter from the Grand Lodge in Canada in Ontario on 1879. Yay. These original dispensations were cited for historical precedent only. As in most provinces, the primary Grand Lodge issuing the warrant did not remain the governing body for long, as both civil and military migrations and growth contributed to change as well as the eventual formation of independent Grand Lodges. Well, of course. The English emulation became the most prevalent and eventually assumed the title Canadian Rite. It would seem that the ancient York Rite reached us directly from the sponsorship of American jurisdictions and lodges, which were warranted during the expedition against Canada. In Newfoundland, the original lodges were warranted from Massachusetts and ceased to exist by 1832. But the craft was revived in 1848 under dispensation from the provincial Grand Master in Nova Scotia. Then they made direct petition to the Grand Lodge of England and were granted a charter for St. John's Lodge 579, dated the 5th of June, 1850. It is still working. The District Grand Lodge was created in 1870 and celebrated its centennial in 1970. The Grand Lodge of Scotland chartered Lodge Tasker in number 454 in 1856, just 6 years after. And, Tasker, nice scotch. Did they name that after Smoky, wonderful in the winter? And they celebrated their centennial in 1966. Man. To this day, Newfoundland supports two district Grand Lodges, that of the United Grand Lodge of England and the Grand Lodge of Scotland. All but two of the English constituted lodges now practice the emulation or Canadian work, the others employing ancient York. The Scottish lodges now practice the standard ritual of Scottish Freemasonry, but formerly used the Duncan, which was written but passed by word of mouth only. The harmony which exists between the two governing bodies is exemplary and inspires mutual cooperation in many beneficent ventures. Now, Prince of Rhode Island, at the time it was named St. John, received her first warrant from Halifax on October 9th, 1797, for St. John Lodge number 26. This remained a solitary lodge until 1827. That's a long time. What's that, 30 years? Yeah, 30 years it was one Masonic lodge. In, of course, Prince of Rhode Island being small. In 1859, Victoria Lodge was warranted by the Grand Lodge of Scotland. When Nova Scotia formed its own Grand Lodge in 1869, Prince of Rhode Island applied to England and was made a district to that body, and appointment of a provincial Grand Master was made in 1870. One Scottish lodge continued in Charlottetown. Then, in 1873, having observed the successful formation of Grand Lodges in other jurisdictions, and having entered Confederation, Prince Edward Island decided to do the same. Their own Grand Lodge came into fruition in 1875. They first decided to adopt the working of the New Brunswick Grand Lodge based on the Massachusetts ritual. And I can tell you from family connections that the travel and contact between New Brunswick and Prince Edward Island is exceptional. It's a very, very fluid. These are busy Masons, wonderful, wonderful fellows. And to all the family members down there, say Merry Christmas to y'all. Hunker down. I heard you're having a bit of an ice storm, so be careful on the roads. This was not exercise, you know. They first decided to adopt New Brunswick Grand Lodge, the workings, but it wasn't, said, yeah, but nobody did it. And the lodges continued to use the web work, which was published in New York. One lodge implemented the look to the east ritual, which was almost the same, the former being ciphered, the web work, the latter being completely written out. Later, the Nova Scotia work was recommended by the Board of General Purposes and adopted. However, objection from some lodges resulted in yet another change of opinion, and Grand Lodge reinstated the old work, but allowed lodges the prerogative to practice the Nova Scotia work under a dispensation from the Grand Master. Therefore, there are two versions of the ancient York work employed in Prince Edward Island. And when you're talking to the boys, they're very keenly aware. They're very, very keenly aware. If you're down in Wheaton and you're talking to the boys in my grandfather's lodge, they're keenly aware of different versions and are very curious and active about talking about our ritual and our work. There's a curiosity. It's wonderful. It's wonderful. And you see that there's different versions. So a little bit of respect there. Nova Scotia, after the founding of the first lodge in Canada in 1738 in Annapolis by Phillips, he was made the provincial Grand Master by a warrant from Massachusetts. The ancient Grand Lodge of England chartered lodges in Halifax and established a provincial Grand Lodge in 1757. St. Andrew's Lodges met continuously from the 19th of July, 1750. Then the Grand Lodge of Scotland chartered Thistle Lodge, and it's now known as Keith No. 17, in 1827, and later the Provincial Grand Lodge. Scottish lodges in turn gave birth to the Grand Lodge of Nova Scotia in 1866, which was ultimately joined by the English lodges in 1869. One lodge retained its allegiance to the United Grand Lodge of England. It should be mentioned here that Cape Breton Island was set off as a separate province in 1785, and then that its first lodge was formed in Sydney in 1786. In 1820, the island gave up its separate political and Masonic existences and merged with Nova Scotia. The work in Nova Scotia is predominantly ancient York, with a small majority practicing English or Canadian work. Again, you see that comfortable blending. It is interesting to read a report of the Grand Lodge proceedings. The ancient York work was exemplified, and this ritual, as practiced in the state of New York, was adopted, with permission to two particular lodges working the rituals of the Grand Lodge of England and Canada to continue to do so. So we might feel a little bit redundant, that the Provincial Grand Lodge of Nova Scotia at this time was called the Worshipful Grand Lodge of the Most Ancient and Honorable Fraternity of Free and Accepted Masons in the Province of Nova Scotia in North America, and the Masonic jurisdiction thereto belonging. Fantastic. New Brunswick. It remained in the Provincial Grand Lodge of Halifax when she became a separate colony in 1874. And there were numerous military lodges there, as it makes sense, but most were disbanded in 1783 with the departure of the Loyalist provincial residents. Their first warrant from Halifax dated in 1789, although there was one was found, they have found a bit of obscure reference from 1784 for Hiram Lodge. The present Grand Lodge was instituted in 1867, and it adopted the Massachusetts or ancient York ritual, similar to Nova Scotia and Prince of Rhode Island. Here in Quebec, we must bend the rules a little bit to establish the early history to accommodate the traveling warrants of the military lodges. The Grand Lodge of Ireland first issued them in 1737, and England followed their example several years later. There is no telling how early the first military masons opened their first lodge in Quebec, or for that matter anywhere in Canada, but we are still aware of their presence and their valuable contribution to Freemasonry's history. The Grand Lodge in Boston issued warrants for lodges during the expedition against Canada. That was between, a little reminder, 1756 and 1758. And there were six new lodges contributing. They formed six new lodges. About the same time, the Grand Lodge of Scotland appointed Colonel Young of the 60th Regiment as Provincial Grand Master of America. A Provincial Grand Lodge was established in 1759, subsequent to the conquest at Quebec under the authority of the Grand Lodge of England. Eight lodges with field warrants were made. Five were Irish, one Scottish, and two English, and they celebrated the St. John Festival in December, where Lieutenant Gannett of the 47th Regiment was elected Provincial Grand Master and was succeeded by Colonel Simon Fraser of the 78th Regiment the following year. Then in 1822, its jurisdiction was divided into two Provincial Grand Lodges, one for the District of Quebec and Three Rivers, Trois-Rivières, wonderful city. By the way, if you've ever been there, hospitality is fantastic. The other for the District of Montreal and William Henry. It is claimed by one writer, R.J. Neil Sren, S-R-E-N, that the emulation working was introduced to Canada by the latter body. That would be the District of Quebec, the Provincial Grand Lodge, huh? These two grand institutions continued until 1855 when the Grand Lodge of Canada was formed. Now, there's a question Sren brings up. He's saying that this emulation working was introduced to Canada by one of the two provincial Grand Lodges, one for the District of Quebec and Three Rivers and the other for the District of Montreal. Let's say we have a look. If any of you know anything about that period of history, if you'd mind sending me an article, that'd be great. The present Grand Lodge of Quebec was established in 1869, and they adopted a revised version of the emulation or Canadian work from the Grand Lodge of Canada in 1874. Scottish lodges joining the Grand Lodge of Quebec in 1881 were permitted to retain their Scottish working. Several lodges in Montreal work in the French language, and one preserves some elements found in the French rituals, and some lodges bordering the United States exemplify the ancient York work. The widest, however, is the emulation or in use is the emulation or Canadian work. Ontario. As mentioned, the military lodge of Fort Niagara was the predecessor of all others in Ontario. It's difficult to differentiate between early Ontario and Quebec geographically until they became Upper and Lower Canada in 1792. Then the Grand Lodge of England appointed Captain William Jarvis as substitute Grand Master. Very poor records are kept of this era, but apparently St. John's Lodge was renamed St. John's Lodge of Friendship No. 2. There is no record beyond 1810 of this lodge. Following the American Revolution in 1793, Colonel Simcoe moved his troops from Newark, Niagara-on-the-Lake, to York, Toronto, where Rawdon Lodge was set up in 1790. In 1797, Jarvis moved the seat of the Provincial Grand Lodge to York, and that was because he moved there. If you truth be known, you know, practical kind of move. And this pissed off the brethren in Newark. Newark, that's Niagara-on-the-Lake, remember? Now, remember that lake. You think this is like early days in Masonry. So he said, all right, my job's going into York, so I'm going to move to the center. You can imagine how much conversation was there going on about that one. They operated as an authorized Grand Lodge, even to the extent of forwarding reports and fees to England. And the War of 1812 broke out, 1812-1814, and that just made a mess of Freemasonry in Ontario. When the Grand Master died in 1817 and the Morgan Affair followed, Masonry indeed, you know, we weren't doing well. During the period of 1812, Simon McGilvery was appointed a Grand Master, and although he didn't devote his whole attention to the task, he at least kept the craft in operation until his death in 1840. Revival under the Third Grand Lodge began under Zeba Phillips. Simultaneously, in 1842, Sir Alan McNab was appointed Provincial Grand Master by the Grand Lodge of Scotland, which he announced after St. Andrew's Lodge petitioned to the Grand Lodge of England in 1845 to appoint Thomas Gibbs Ridout as Provincial Grand Master. This was successful, and it is astonishing to learn that he was first appointed Grand Master when he was a fellow craft. I don't know if that's astonishing, given the period. Ridout did not fulfill his duties. We should take a look at that. And he was absent from many meetings. This unfortunate situation, coupled with the seeming indifferent attitude adopted by the Grand Lodge of England and the urging of lodges under the Grand Lodge of Ireland, which also functioned at the time, moved the brethren to take steps to incorporate an independent Grand Lodge. The meeting in Hamilton on the 10th of October, 1855, 41 lodges from as far east as Montreal and west as Windsor sent delegates. They voted 40-1 to form a Grand Lodge of Canada and elected Grand Master William Mercer Wilson. There you go. 40-1. Acceptance of this new Grand Lodge was not immediate by other Grand Lodges. However, in 1857, the Provincial Grand Lodge met for the last time. Then in 1858, McNab's ancient Grand Lodge dissolved and threw in with the Grand Lodge of Canada. Not all lodges affiliated with the new organization. In fact, there was another Grand Lodge of Ontario formed for a short time, about 20 years. This was the first Grand Lodge at various times passed through through the different titles. Provincial Grand Lodge, Provincial Grand Lodge of Canada West, Ancient Grand Lodge of Canada, Grand Lodge of Free and Accepted Masons of Canada. Different titles. Mercifully, in 1867, the name Grand Lodge of Canada in the province of Ontario was adopted following Confederation and has been perpetuated. The simple title, Grand Lodge of Canada of Ontario, was not available for their use because another clandestine group had registered that title as its own. Ah, you've wondered that. Grand Lodge of Saskatchewan, Grand Lodge of Quebec, Grand Lodge of Ontario. So, the emulation or Canadian ritual is almost exclusively practiced in Ontario, with notable exceptions in London using the Irish work. And we know about that, and we are. Some of us are fortunate to be able to attend and witness and experience step into history. Now we move on to Manitoba and Churchill on Hudson's Bay. So that's interesting. The simple title Grand Lodge of Ontario was not available for their use because another clandestine group had registered that title as their own. At Churchill and Hudson's Bay stand the ruins of Fort Prince of Wales, built by the Hudson's Bay Company about 1733. And built into the fortress is a massive block of stone on which can be seen the distinctive individual mark of the operative mason who cut the stone. More than that, we know nothing about whether he or they were speculative or operative, but there is much interesting to tell of what we do know. Surprisingly, it may seem to many, masonry in Manitoba received its first dispensation from Minnesota on the 20th of May of 1864 to meet at the Red River Settlement. And it was named Northern Light Lodge and emerged, maybe like the one over in Stainer, sister lodge, I guess, and emerged from Hatch's Independent Battalion of Calgary, Minnesota Volunteers, a unit organized for the express purpose of securing the Sioux Indians who had been in revolt in 1862 for a whole year. They had been ordered to the border at Pembina in Dakota Territory. And one Lieutenant Mix rode to the Red River Settlement to enlist the services of the governor of the settlement in the connection with the pursuit of the band of Sioux Indians by the U.S. cavalry into Canadian territory. Rather sad period of history, isn't it? There was apparently fraternal conversation as well. For later, a news item in the Nor'wester relates details of the party from the settlement journeying to Pabima to join the Masonic Lodge there. Masons from the ranks under the leadership of C.W. Nash, who became Worshipful Master, secured a dispensation from the Grand Lodge of Minnesota to form Northern Light Lodge at Pabima. It was accomplished and the inaugural meeting was held in January of 1864. We know from letters written by the Worshipful Master that the desire of the Lodge, as well as interested parties in Fort Garry to become members of the craft, were made clear. Unfortunately, 5 months later in May, the soldiers were moved to Fort Abercrombie, and all the papers, records, and petitions and documents, along with the dispensation, were returned to the Grand Lodge of Minnesota. This did not end the matter, however, because three Canadian brethren who had been active in the military lodge arranged for five more Canadians to journey to Pabima to receive their degrees before the exodus of the lodge. It appears that they received their three degrees at this one meeting, which was not uncommon in those days. These faithful brethren, wishing to ensure the enduring practice of Masonry in the West, made petition to Minnesota, and their dispensation was granted on the 20th of May, 1864. Remember, Canada wasn't shaped the way it is today. You know, provinces were added gradually. It was named Northern Light Lodge, and it met in Red River Settlement in a room above the store of A.G.B. Bannatyne. The inaugural meeting of the lodge was held on the 8th of November, 1864, and John Schultz was a member who was elected the Worshipful Master. Andrew G.B. Bannatyne, Sr. was made warden, and William Inkster was the junior warden. This marked the first regular meeting of a Masonic lodge in the Canadian Northwest. Trouble developed in the settlement over the transfer of the territory, and labor seems to have been suspended at the end of 1867, but Masonry at least had a footprint in the West. And with the passage of the Rupert's Land Act in 1868, things became very dodgy and unstable, and Riel took over Fort Garry. The eventual reestablishment of constituted authority happened with Lord Wolsey's expedition, and in his troops, several Masons decided to remain in the West when the force was dispersed, and they organized the Winnipeg Lodge. They had a dispensation, of course. And the first meeting was the 10th of December, 1870, and later changed the name to Prince Rupert's Lodge, receiving their charter under the name from the Grand Lodge of Canada, number 240 in the Grand Register. The Worshipful Master was R. Stuart Patterson, chaplain to the forces, and the senior warden, Lieutenant William N. Kennedy, and his junior warden, Sergeant Major Matthew Coyne. Freemasonry flourished and saw the formation of the Grand Lodge of Manitoba on the 12th of May, 1875. At one point in 1878, there was a temporary setback because of a schism. The rival Grand Lodge challenged for recognition because of ritual differences, but the problem was resolved. American or ancient York ritual came up with the U.S. Cavalry and later with the newcomers from the Maritimes. The English or Canadian work with the British soldiers of Wolseley's expedition and migrants from Quebec and Ontario. The rift which occurred because of these ritual differences were overcome. So today, both of these workings are recognized by the Grand Lodge of Manitoba and practiced in her lodges. Saskatchewan, the schism which existed between these two rival Grand Lodges in Manitoba, preempted Saskatchewan to seek her first dispensation from the Grand Lodge of Canada in Ontario. Manitoba was quarreling, had issues. A group of dedicated Masons met at the Hudson's Bay store in Prince Albert on 28th of March to discuss forming a Masonic Lodge, and the first meeting in Kanisto Lodge was held on the 8th of October of 1879, and it was warranted on the 14th of July, 1880. Manitoba settled the schismatic problem, and in 1882 transferred all allegiance from the Grand Lodge of Canada in Ontario, and made the Grand Lodge of Manitoba and Saskatchewan. Having observed the forming of Grand Lodge of Alberta in 1905, and with the added impetus of the establishment of Saskatchewan and Alberta as provinces, Saskatchewan Masons held a meeting of Prince Albert at Prince Albert on the 25th of May in 1905, where they decided it was advisable to create a Grand Lodge of Saskatchewan, which happened on the 3rd of August the next year, 1906. The enthusiasm of our forefathers was, we have to just be amazed. Here's a little following. This came from the Capel Valley Lodge in 1891. I witnessed the conferring of a first degree in a most impressive manner. The candidate, a rancher, had ridden 62 miles on horseback to be present. He had to leave for home immediately after being initiated. He thus undertook a journey by saddle horse of 124 miles to receive his first degree. We should remember and learn. Saskatchewan had almost total uniformity in Canadian rite work in their lodges, with the exception of two which practiced the ancient York, with the sanction of the Grand Lodge. British Columbia, the other side of the mountains, where things are wonderful and they live in La La Land. Do you have winter out there, BC? You know, snow. Come over here. We'll show you snow. I think I'll get my iPhone out and send them some pictures. The peaks and valleys of the Pacific Coastal Range, and the way, it was a pattern in the early days of Masonic history. Things were different even then. Our brethren encountered a multiplicity of problems. The indomitable spirit of these fellows carried. From a meeting in a store in Victoria, a petition was forwarded to the Grand Lodge of England on the 12th of July, 1858, which resulted in the return of a warrant 2 years later. The dedication of Victoria Lodge took place in August that year under the direction of Robert Burnaby. The first worshipful master was Joseph Condicate. In 1862, Union Lodge was formed in Westminster, then the capital of the mainland colony of BC. It began with the English work, but in 1877, just 15 years later, the lodge had voted to adopt the Scottish work. Newcomers to the colonies of Vancouver and BC from California had been attracted by the gold rush and coal discoveries, found the Masonic rituals of the two English lodges strange and unfamiliar. Now, we find today, brethren, that the work in California is very close to the standard here in Grand Lodge of Canada and the province of Ontario. Let's just think, how did that occur? Or were we influential? I like to think so. Consequently, after finding that the rituals here were different, the Americans petitioned the Grand Lodge of Washington Territories to form a lodge of their own in Victoria to work on. They wanted, we've got an American right, so blah, blah, blah. This met with disapproval voiced by Victoria that all charters come from the mother country. A sponsorship was rushed by application being made to the Grand Lodge of Scotland, where liberal ritual recognition policy would allow the operation of the American rite, yet fulfilled the qualification of Victoria regarding the mother country sponsorship. This lodge became Vancouver Lodge number 421, late in 1862 under the Grand Lodge of Scotland. By 1871, there were five Scottish and four English lodges warranted. All but one of the Scottish lodges expressed a desire to form an independent Grand Lodge. All but one of the English lodges opposed the petition. Despite refusal of permission of the Grand Lodge of Scotland, a meeting was called for 18th March 1871 to discuss this. Normal objection by the provincial Grand Master successfully interrupted their plans, and in spite of electing Dr. I.W. Powell as Grand Master, the new Grand Lodge was postponed indefinitely. Feelings ran high in the two sections of the craft, but ultimately it was agreed mutually that the independent Grand Lodge was in their best interest. On the 21st of October, 1871, a convention was held in Victoria, attended by representatives of all lodges except one of the English section. A unanimous vote in favor of an autonomous Grand Lodge of British Columbia was recorded, and Dr. I.W. Powell was elected Grand Master, and Robert Burnaby was an honorary past Grand Master. The single dissenting lodge did, in fact, affiliate the following year. It is interesting to note that it was not until 1874, 3 years' duration, that the Grand Lodge of England afforded recognition to the Grand Lodge of British Columbia. Good form there. 9 years elapsed before the Grand Lodge of Scotland relaxed their strident stance and acknowledged Grand Lodge of British Columbia. in 1880, then only with certain specific reservations. Later, the founders of a new lodge, principally from Australia, who had landed in Vancouver after participating in the Klondike Gold Rush, was granted permission to implement the ritual adopted in New South Wales, described as an impressive and erudite ritual made up of what a committee deemed the best of the Irish, English, and Scottish rituals. This lodge became Lodge Southern Cross No. 44 in 1906. Thus, we find there are four types of rituals being exercised in BC: the Canadian or Ontario, American, English, and New South Wales. It is also interesting to note that some of the American lodges use the, quote, Look to the East ritual book of Ralph P. Lester, which is considered spurious by many jurisdictions. I don't know this. If any of you are familiar with it, drop me a line. Alberta, finally, and we look at the original Masonic Lodge. It was chartered from the Grand Lodge of Manitoba. Was Saskatchewan Lodge number 17, which met at Edmonton. There was no relationship to the present-day lodge by the same name. It was dispensated in 13 January 1882. They elected Philip Hermeck, the worshipful master, and James Kirshen, the senior warden, and Ralph Robert Burton, the junior warden. Originally started in 13 charter members, the transient nations so reduced their numbers that the remaining members felt obliged to surrender their charter to the Grand Lodge of Manitoba. But Alberta Masons were not so easily discouraged, and 40 of them met in George Murdoch's shack in Calgary to organize a lodge. They subscribed sums of $5 to $25 each in either money or lumber to erect a lodge in Calgary. It was first decided that they would petition the Grand Lodge of British Columbia for dispensation, but it was finally agreed because of the natural barrier of the Rocky Mountains and the easier access to Winnipeg, they should apply to the Grand Lodge of Manitoba itself. On the 10th of January 1884, a dispensation was granted to Bow River Lodge to meet in Calgary on the Monday before the full moon. This is what is referred to colloquially as a moon lodge or lunar lodge. It was instituted on the 28th of January 1884, and its charter dated from the 14th of February 1884, Valentine's Day. 24 petitioners had recommended that M.J. Lindsay be worshipful master, George Murdoch, the senior warden, and Fred E. Newman, the junior warden. Hear, hear. And then the Bow River Lodge members got busy and passed a resolution on the 14th of January 1889 that the past masters and wardens of the lodge be formed into a committee of the lodge to confer with other lodges to form a Grand Lodge. On the 20th of April 1890, just a year later, it was decided by the lodge to grant $200 from the Grand Lodge from the lodge treasury as a guarantee fund toward the establishment of a Grand Lodge. Members present at that meeting also signed a guarantee amounting to upwards of $300. So there's a lot of money in the day. It was resolved at the 20th of June 1890 meeting that a convention of lodges would be located at Medicine Hat, Lethbridge, Anthracite, and Pincher's Creek to be held in Calgary with Bow River Lodge to consider formation of a provincial Grand Lodge. Alberta was not yet a province, and this technically presented jurisdictional problems. And so things waited until 1905, on the 19th of April, communication to Bow River Lodge from the worshipful master brother O.W. Healy of Medicine Hat suggested a conference of delegates. Yeah, on Victoria Day, 24th of May, 1905, to pursue the subject of a Grand Lodge. Here, the representatives that have showed up were Bow River number 28, Medicine Hat number 31, Alberta number 37, McLeod Prefectuing number 60, and Eureka 65, Acacia number 66, Red Deer 73, Jasper 78, and Wetaskiwin 83. On the 12th of August, 1905, Right Worshipful Brother Hogben issued a notice to all lodges in Alberta to convene once more, and 17 of the then 18 lodges working there did show up. And on the 12th of October 1905, the new Grand Lodge of Alberta was duly constituted and officers elected and installed. So that gives you, in 1935, the Grand Lodge of Alberta decided to extend its boundaries by annexing the portion of the Northwest Territories lying to the west of the 4th Meridian, extending to the easterly boundary of the Yukon. And this extension made Alberta the largest inland area of any Grand Lodge jurisdiction in North America. So when I was up in, as a matter of fact, when I was up in Yellowknife, there was a lodge there that operated under the Grand Lodge of Alberta. So still to this day. Now this is work, and all due. I want you to know this work came from Brother Myron Lusk, L-U-S-K, and I think it's just a sensational paper on history. And you'll find this if you want. Take a look at this for yourself. Go to Masonic World, all one word, .com, and look for the history and development of Freemasonry in Canada. That's MasonicWorld.com, the history and development of Freemasonry in Canada. Now, this has been, so let's move on. That's a little bit about the history. So you see, came back to Alberta, but, you know, the history of Canada and the development of provinces that wasn't following, leading Freemasonry. So there was accommodation made all the time. Rather interesting, I thought. So, do you have it? I hope so. I know you're still tired and hungover from the winter solstice celebrations. I don't blame you a bit. Here we have, and now we're only 2 days, 14 hours, and 43 minutes away from Christmas. So. I want to talk to you a little bit about lunar or moon lodges in Masonic history, and ask you to think a little bit about this. I want to report to you, and I don't have it now, the number of lunar lodges that once upon a time that existed in Ontario. And I don't have that yet, but I will. I'm searching it out. So when I do, I know that I was initiated into a lodge that once upon a time met on the Wednesday following the full moon, and that's not unheard of for you. You'll know that. You'll realize that yourself. But it wasn't uncommon. Many lodges met around a time predicted by the declared or determined by the event of the full moon, and that meant that the lunar calendar changes, so the date of these meetings could change, and it also meant that Freemasons made a calculation. You had to actually calculate. It wasn't a date. Show up here at this time as we have today. So we had to make an accommodation. Now, many lodges don't do that today, but I wondered about enough what else we might have given up in that period. So, we don't, but there was something about a calculation by a group of men who are serious-minded fellows that is determined by one of the very first measurements of time, the moon, the presence of the moon and the movement of the moon. I guess the major and primary watch was the sun. Sun rose, sun set. So I found an article on the moon in Masonic history, and this is written by the Grand Historian from the Grand Lodge of Vermont. It tends to have a little bit of credibility, or at least it does for me, and I hope it does for you. I'll fill in a little bit, but as I go through this, a little bit of the history of lunar lodges, or moon lodges, as they're called, I want you to think, did we give up, and what did, I'm convinced that we did, what did we give up? did we give up when we calculated it? It was like, what did we give up when we moved all of the, a lot of the installations to June? What did we gain? Well, what did we give up? That was around St. John Day, wasn't it? In December, when a lot of the lodges and some still do. They didn't change. I mean, it wasn't that long ago where that was, suggested, and many lodges continued. So give it a, what do you think yourself? If anything, perhaps you were of the mind that there was nothing lost when we did that. And perhaps you're bang on. And this is just more idle speculation. But maybe not. I think it defines us differently if we're saying that I'm going to a meeting, a member of an organization, and you ask me when the meetings are, and I look at the calendar and determine. So this is going way, way back in time. What else is determined by the moon? Well, Easter is the high Christian holiday. It's determined by the moon. When is Easter? Well, it moves along with the advent of the first full moon following the end of Lent. So check this out. That is really old school. And I'm sort of asking myself, what was the problem with that? What was the problem with that? Is this an artifact? We move away from that because we drifted into a period of social slumber where we were of a mind that man could command nature, that we were the masters of everything. This is a social phenomenon not that long ago. Then we found books, materials coming out, Limits to Growth came out in the 60s, where we began to realize that, the impact of a lifestyle was having an effect on our environment. Today, it's not unusual for us to be thinking about whether we throw the garbage out the window of the car or whether we drive the car. Now, to be honest, the greatest source of pollution in my life is an automobile. And the lifestyle that I live is not set up where I can just walk to work and walk to the stores. And in my heart, yes, I would. I would give up the car. But cars allowed us mobility. So I can see in one single day, if I choose, I can drive and see my friends up in, I can see Michael, go and see the Grand Historian up in Ottawa. And while I'm there, I'll stop in and see Angus Gillis. Fine man. I can go and do this in a day. Now, yeah, and if I was in Europe, I'd be scooting through a couple of countries. If I headed west, what am I, 2 or 3 days to the Manitoba border? I like to lollygag and look around. I'll stop and have a nice meal here and there and, find an inn that's always welcoming. I like the hospitality of the north. I really do. My latest excursion was up to Sault Ste. Marie. The fellows are fantastic. They're just amazing. Anyway, let me talk to you a little bit. Think about that. What did we give up? Or did we give up anything? And what did we gain? And you tell me. Sometimes if the world was a simpler place, I'd say, I want to go back. I want to, but I know I can't. But then I can think, well, can I restore some things? Yeah, I think I can. I want to restore some things that are worth keeping. And we tried. I think, maybe some of these changes were social experiments. And it echoes the back of my mind, the excitement that's going on around some of new lodges, relatively new lodges, that are practicing a fairly prescribed type of meeting. And I'm speaking really of a strict observance lodge. The attendance is like 100%, no shortage of candidates. The work is impeccable. lodges, officers are moved according to merit. This is, you know, it's wonderful to see this kind of diversification. And the ritual is, of course, for Canadian ritual. All the rest, the attitude, everybody gets it. You go there because that's something that speaks to you as a Mason. And having experienced it a couple of times, it is quite striking and quite remarkable. It's very satisfying, very pleasing, and it nurtures the Masonic soul, the Masonic genes inside of me somewhere, whether it's Masonic mitochondria. I have to talk to my friend John about that. But Goss, the grand historian, says this about the moon. I think you see as I go through this, what part has any meaning to you? There's no more spectacular reminder of our Masonic historical and ritualistic history than the moon at its height of fullness. Can we all say that? I think so. I think we can. Ah, man. While astronomers view the moon with the analytical eye of science, the moon has been a focal point for cultures around the world throughout history. We've known that, huh? And it's inspired music, and it's inspired poetry and religion alike. However, for Masons, the moon has not just been a symbolic light in our ritualistic teaching, but also a literal light in our brethren. We need to take a moment just to think about the moon and its association with the craft and our origins. Our direct Masonic tradition regarding the moon begins with the ancient Hebrews. In Genesis 1:14-19, we are told that on the fourth day of creation, God made two great lights, the greater light to rule the day and the lesser light to rule the night. Despite the specific prohibitions against lunar worship in Deuteronomy, you don't want to do that. Remember, up until not too long ago, you didn't want to be out under the moonlight created madness. Remember the term lunacy? Luna? Despite the specific prohibitions against lunar worship in Deuteronomy and the Book of Kings, the moon was still regarded as a strong... Now get your Bibles out and go and take a look at that. It was still regarded as a strong symbol of permanence and regularity associated with its usage to measure the passage of time. The monthly offerings to the moon found in Numbers 28:11-15 are still read in some Jewish synagogues. It is from the medieval, 63 books in the Bible, isn't there? So those are a couple of you can check out. Interesting. It is from the medieval European science of alchemy that the first uses of the moon in the graphic and ritualistic manner that Masons are accustomed to derive their meaning. The alchemists were a group of mystics who first appeared in the 12th century and were the forerunners of the modern chemists. They believed that with the proper mixture of chemicals and methods, base metals such as iron and lead could be turned into gold and silver. However, beyond this, the alchemists were true philosophers who used symbols and drawings extensively in their teachings and who insisted on strict secrecy from their initiates. Much of the graphic symbolism used in masonry, such as images of the plum, the square, the level, the rough ashlar, and perfect ashlar, were taken from alchemical texts. Yeah. To the alchemists, the moon was a symbol of the metal silver and was used to depict the substance in the obscure writings which transmitted their secret formula. One of the most prevalent images used by the alchemists was a stylized drawing of the sun and the moon with human faces. These images are now associated with the Masonic tracing boards of England and monitors of such American Masonic rituals as Jeremy Cross, who lectured at the lodges in Vermont in 1815. It is in the craft ritual and the structure of the Masonic Lodge itself that we must bring ourselves together, all of the foregoing elements, to give a true picture of the use of the moon in Freemasonry. In modern American ritual, the primary reference to the moon is as the second of the lesser lights of Masonry. Yeah, we have that, don't we? The sun, through to rule the day, the moon to rule the night, and the master to rule the life. This modern usage follows from the early 18th century English ritual reference to the three lights of the lodge being the sun, the moon, and the master mason. In addition to these movable lights, there was also in these early English lodge rooms three fixed lights, which are described by some historians as three windows in the lodge room to light men to, at, and from their work. These three windows were later replaced with three candles located in the east, south, and west corners of the lodge and situated before the master, the junior warden, and senior warden, respectively. The reference to the sun, the moon, and master of the lodge as the three lesser lights of masonry and their particular association with these three burning tapers and the associated officers was developed by the so-called ancient Grand Lodge, which was active in England from the mid to late 18th century. The ancients, who apparently consisted of Masons hailing from Scotland and Ireland, were at odds with another faction of Masons in England, the so-called Premier Grand Lodge. The ritual of the Premier Grand Lodge was referred only to three great lights without the ancient reference to the lesser lights. The fact that the ancients held to the above interpretation of the three lesser lights was particularly significant for American masonry, as was their use of deacons in their degree work. Yeah, the deacons came from the ancients, that process of reconciliation. In modern American web work ritual, the moon is referred to in the first degree as one of the three lesser or movable lights and is identified as the biblical ruler of the night, and as a reference of regularity for the conduct of the master in the lodge. In the higher symbolism of the lodge, the moon has always been particularly identified with the senior warden in the west, thus following the Egyptian tradition associating the moon with this direction. This reference also corresponds with the recitation of the senior warden's duties in the lodge. I won't get into that. You all know. Think about the lecture. Some Masonic philosophers have found this to be a fitting parallel, for as the light of the moon is a mere reflection of the great light of the sun, so the senior warden, the officer associated with the Doric pillar of strength, is intended to be a reflection of the light of the worshipable master, who is associated with the Ionic pillar of wisdom. Senior warden, the Doric pillar of strength. Worshipful master, the Ionic pillar of wisdom. It is thus particularly significant that the messenger of the senior warden within the lodge is the junior deacon, who, as his jewel, wears the square and compasses enclosing the moon. There is one other strong association of the moon with masonry, which in many ways is more meaningful than all of the above. In the early 1800s, when masonry was still a relatively new venture, things were wild and unsettled, and it's difficult for us to imagine the thoughts and feelings of a 19th century mason stepping into the bitter cold of a winter night after a lodge meeting to pursue his travel home. For him, a trip of several miles at night after a lodge meeting was a major undertaking, where even the task of finding one's way was formidable. And man, if you've been on Prince Edward Island when there's been no moon, you cannot, if you touch your nose with your finger, you cannot even think of seeing your finger. There's nothing. Many of the lodges and other jurisdictions adopted the custom of holding their meetings during the week of the full moon. And so the lodges became known as moon lodges. Light, perfect streetlights. Following the phases of the moon was no trouble at all for country folk in the 19th and early 20th centuries. And the brilliant lesser light provided a deacon that guided our elderly brethren home along dirt roads and beaten paths. In 1817, 26 of the 40 lodges in Vermont, for example, were moon lodges. Now we'll find out what was going on over here. See, that gives you a little bit of a taste. So there was a practical element. So, you know, we use the light, but there was also, a history that went back to, symbolism of Egypt and early, predates the scripture that we use. And it made me wonder. It absolutely made me wonder if there wasn't more that we were giving up than we were gaining. So, this is, don't trouble yourself with this notion of pagan, that whole term. That came about, that was brought in by the, Christian missionaries some time ago in the first centuries. They were just upset that people were living in these communities with local and regional religious creeds. They're doing well. They had their own, things were stable, but, that wasn't enough for the proselytizing missionaries in early days. So they wanted to convert. So they said, these are, don't do that. This pagan ritual is wrong. But some of those traditions, the way that things were practiced have still gone on today. Oh, my. Christmas tree. 17th century German invention. It clearly derives from the pagan practice of bringing greenery indoor to decorate in midwinter. And the modern Santa Claus is a direct descendant of England's Father Christmas. And he wasn't originally a gift giver. Our Father Christmas and his other European variations are modern incarnations of old pagan ideas about spirits who travel the sky in midwinter. Dark days accumulate with the shortest day of the year, winter solstice. So now, what's coming, brethren? Summer. Summer, the sun is coming back, and we can measure it. We can measure it. Fantastic. Thank you for joining me again today. We've got to wrap this up. I hope you're enjoying the season spirit. Bring it with you. Bring it with you wherever you go. You know that random Masonic act of kindness that I'm always talking about? Well, what could be more pleasing and kind to do to for our fellow man than to bring a moment of happiness into their life? Bring a smile. Work on it. Be grumpy. Nobody gives a crap about your grumpiness. Nobody gives a crap about your temper. It's all been done before. If you're that unhappy with your life, suck it up. You're amazing. Oh dear, did I say that out loud? No, I don't think anybody heard that, did they? Well, let's see what we can get away with here. Merry Christmas, everybody. I look forward to seeing you soon.
This Duracell truck has some very special power.
I'm pulling this off of the computer, gentlemen, so bear with me. A little bit of, just wanted to share a little bit of the season. Amazing what the human voice can do, and just how inspiring it can be. Brethren, I wish you all a very, very Merry Christmas and the most prosperous New Year. I may do, of course, I'll do a Christmas show. Do one on, around Christmas Day. And not, other than the reason that it's just such a pleasure to be with you. And in the meantime, I hope you're you're doing well. Get ready for the holidays, if you're not already. And stay in touch. I think it's fabulous. So let's see what I can get out of here. But by the way, this music is from King's College. What gets better? Just seems to speak. This is from the chapel of King's College at Cambridge University.
Beloved in Christ, we gather this Christmas Eve to hear the message of Gabriel, to journey with the shepherds and with the Magi to kneel in awe and adoration before the gift of the light of the world. In words and in music, we seek to understand and to marvel at the wonder of the Incarnation. As we meet to offer our praises and our prayers to the Christ child, let us pray first for the needs of the world, for the poor, the hungry, the homeless, for the persecuted, and for the bereaved. Let us, too, remember all those whom we have loved but see no longer, those whose lives have influenced and enriched our own, and who now rejoice with us, but on another shore and with a greater understanding. We pray that we may this night be so filled with the love of God that our lives may reflect the light of his glory and of his infinite compassion.
Thank you. Yeah.